Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
So you have to run out right after the show to get to opening day, or what?
Once again, Jim, I will not be going.
You ever been to opening day?
Never.
You're a star columnist.
I'm a loser.
In town. How come you
Big
can't get
loser.
Tickets to opening
day? I don't
day?
Know. Never been. Never
Either
been.
Right. Whatever. In any case, joining us to talk politics, Joanna Weiss is the op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe. She's also a former TV critic, so maybe she can explain to me what happened on Mad Men last night, because I surely don't know.
I watched, and I
Perfect.
Have no idea.
Great. In any case, also with us, Boston Herald's chief enterprise reporter and a new dad of a very large baby. Congratulations. Large, right? Dave Wedge.
He's a big boy.
He's a big. Congratulations.
Thank you. 9 pounds, 11 ounces.
And same to Jessica.
Thank
obviously.
You very much, Jim.
Okay, before we get started, here's a little sound from a probably somebody you never heard of. He's the House Ways and Means Chair. He's a Democrat. Representative Brian Dempsey basically saying that Deval Patrick should not hold his breath getting what he wants on taxes.
Getting to a higher number does not appear at all likely. And I think putting the 500 at risk means that it would be hard for us to get back at this, go back at this year.
So, Dave Wedge, even as we speak, Governor Deval Patrick is up there poised to get croaked by his fellow Democrats because he wanted this $1.9 billion sales tax drop, income mm-hmm. tax increase to fund transportation, to fund education. They're saying they're going to give him $500 million at most, which is a drop. Well, it's not a drop, but it's not what he wants. Is this humiliating and terrible for Deval Patrick?
I don't think it's humiliating for him. It's to be expected. He's said he's not running again, so he has really no political capital anymore. And these guys, you know, DeLeo's been out there saying right from the start, we're not doing this, you know, and there's been the Herald's written a bunch of stories with other reps, you know, coming out of closed door meetings, saying, you know, he's a lame duck. We don't care. This is crazy. Our constituents will not reelect us. And that's what it's about for a lot of these folks. Their constituents are hurting. They can't afford higher gas tax. They can't afford this income tax hit. So, you know, the revenue's got to come from somewhere, some of it. And I think this is kind of the best they think they can do.
Are we a little bit getting nervous, though, about the bridges about to collapse over our heads as we drive up? And you know,
drive quickly, Marjorie. That's the solution.
Chicken Little over here.
Maybe I'm the only one that, well, I've, you know, the Big Dig has made me nervous. I didn't want to go through the tunnel for about 5 years. But, I mean, there is some sentiment. Even in the Herald, we had this poll where people were, almost half of the people in Massachusetts said they were willing to pay more taxes for these improvements.
Well, sure. And I mean, that's the governor's point, right, is that someone's going to have to pay for all of this sooner or later somehow. And so what's the best, fairest, most equitable way to do it? And what's the way that doesn't, you know, kick it all the way down to future generations? And, you know, he does. He doesn't have to worry about running for reelection. He does have his legacy that he's concerned about. And I think that's part of his position.
I don't see how this happened. We have the governors with us for 15 minutes on Fridays. We'll be with us in the studio for an hour tomorrow at noon. I don't get this. Three Democrats. The governor gets along really well with the Speaker of the House, DeLeo. I assume he gets along fairly well with Terry Murray, who's the Senate president. DeLeo told me and others he had no idea what was in the tax package until he heard the governor announce it. The governor said the other day he had no idea what the Democrats in the legislature were going to do until an hour before they did it. It's sort of like the ultimate failure to communicate, is it not, Joanna?
It is. And maybe part of it is that it's sort of a shocking number. You see the governor's number.
$2 billion.
Really? How do you bring Big. That? Oh, by the way, this is what I'm going to do tomorrow. You know, it was a shocking number when I opened up the paper and read it. And you can just imagine how every single constituent who looks at his paycheck every week and says, oh, my God, is going to think about supporting a plan like this.
It's just a tough time to do something like this is what it comes down to. You know, we just – anyone who saw their paycheck after January 1st mm-hmm. saw that 2% loss from the Social Security
– The payroll tax.
Yeah, the payroll tax.
Income tax increase.
And that hurt. That hurt people a lot. You know, that means something. And the governor is a wealthy man. Maybe he doesn't see it. But a lot of these state reps that we're talking about now, they do see it because they don't get
But don't you,
know, they don't
Dave,
have the funds that the governor has.
Do you appreciate the irony that when Deval Patrick proposed the gas tax a few years ago, the legislature said absolutely not, and now he proposes an income tax and they do a gas tax? I mean, what's up with that?
Well, like I said, the revenue's got to come from somewhere, and I think they're finding something that people will accept.
Okay, Joanna, this one's for you because you are a fellow female here. Barack Obama has taken all this grief when he, I thought, rather warmly praised California Attorney General Harris last week for being not just dedicated and brilliant, but, as he put it, she also happens to be by far the best-looking attorney general in the country. Did you take offense at this?
I did a face plant, you know. I mean, I don't think I took personal offense, but it's just such a dumb thing for him to have said, because he, you know, this guy's been in the game for a long time. He should know what kind of reaction he's going to get. It's really not the way you talk about a female politician.
But she's a friend. But she's a friend of his. It isn't like this is an arm's length transaction. From what I read, he's fairly friendly with her. He has a relationship. It was not said like, what's an example, like Brent Musburger talked about how baberific or whatever he said the girlfriend of the quarterback for Alabama was during the national championship game.
It wasn't a personal insult. No, but it was something said, I think it was in a public forum,
yeah,
a fundraiser.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a whole audience of women there who may not know their relationship and may not feel that personal relationship and are going to say, really, this is what you have to say about this woman?
I think he's hanging out with Joe Biden too much.
But, you know, didn't you ever, I mean, maybe you didn't. I know I spent a lot of time in my columns rhapsodizing about the gorgeous good looks of Scott Brown, and I may have once or twice referenced Romney. You know, isn't what's good for the goose good for the
gander? That's not sexist.
It's not?
It's sexist. The
reverse?
Other way.
Reverse
it's a double
sexism?
Standard, right?
There is no
double,
reverse
double
sexism. You can say John Hamm's handsome all day and no one's going to be offended.
I know.
You say, you know, this attorney general, the president saying it, you know, it's a little. It walks a fine line.
It's one of those just watch what you say when you're saying it. You know, I'm sure, and really, in their personal private conversations as friends, is he really saying, oh, you're so good looking? I mean.
Think Martha Coakley was upset or no? Okay. Speaking of the president on a policy matter, last week they leak a piece of his budget. And the critical piece is in an, I guess, an olive branch or something in the Republicans, Dave Wedge. He says, you know that plan you like that would lessen the cost of living increase for seniors on Social Security? I'm going to buy into that as long as you buy into taxes. Republicans aren't crazy about it. And then liberal Democrats like Bernie Sanders from Vermont go absolutely nuts. Here he is on Real Time with Bill Maher the other night.
Elderly people in Vermont trying to get, and around the country, trying to survive on $15,000 a year, seeing what will amount is a $650 cut 10 years from now. That's wrong. If you want to deal with deficit reduction, ask the billionaires to stop paying their fair share of taxes.
You know, Bernie Sanders wasn't alone here, even though he may be the furthest to the left of Democratic senators. My sense is this is exactly what Barack Obama wanted. He wanted liberal Democrats to scream bloody murder so he can basically so that he can say to the American people or activists, listen, this didn't make anybody happy. There, as proof that I'm reaching out to Republicans, my liberal wing of my own party hates this thing, but it's a thing I had to do. Am I right or am I wrong?
No, I think it's a good assessment. You know, I mean,
you don't think so? I can tell. No, but seriously, my sense—it was obvious. This is the reaction he was going to get from liberals because so many, like Elizabeth Warren, ran and said, "I part of my pledge is I will not touch Social Security." So he knew they're going to scream bloody murder. But I think he wanted it. It sort of burnishes his reputation as somebody who is allegedly willing to go where other people will not.
Although being willing to go where other people has not served him very well in the past. I mean, you know, he's in the same bind that he's always been in, where he can't please anybody, and going down that middle path just doesn't seem to have helped him that much politically, all the way, certainly through this whole sequestration situation.
Well, here's Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, who is a senator who usually is one of the people who comes out to say how horrible the president's plans are. Listen to what he had to say about this.
The president's showing a little bit of leg here. This is somewhat encouraging. His overall budget's not going to make it, but he has sort of made a step forward in the entitlement reform process that would allow a guy like me to begin to talk about flattening the tax code and generating more revenue.
You know, don't you think, Jim, Americans know they have to do something about entitlements to get the budget in shape? Maybe Barack Obama's doing the right thing for the United States of America. How about that?
No, it's very possible. And I think, again, one of the ways you show that it's when you anger
your tongue.
Both sides. And by the way, while Lindsey Graham was full of praise, most Republicans are saying, it's fine on Social Security. We're not doing this tax thing. This is the second bite of taxes for Barack Obama. We're just not doing it.
Right. They've always, and that's what he's, again, run into, is this sort of no, no, no roadblock. And then, you know, but you're right. He gets the no, no, no roadblock from the left as well. I mean, how do you forge that middle path? How do you step up and sort of take leadership on this issue without owning the sequestration in sort of a bad way?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, then the blame falls on him as well for sort of for being the guy who's creating the halt.
You know, it's pretty amazing. As we're sitting here, even though, and I'm thinking as all three of you are talking, there is no hope these people are ever going to agree on anything about anything. It is conceivable that before this week's over, there's going to be a bipartisan immigration bill filed in the Senate with some of the most conservative Republicans and some of the most liberal Democrats, Schumer on the liberal side, Marco Rubio on the conservative side, agreeing to a pathway to citizenship for 11, 12, 13 million people. It's pretty incredible, is it?
There is something bipartisan happening, not on guns, not on the budget, on this one issue. Yeah, maybe if we sort of take it issue by issue by issue, we can actually get something done. And maybe if the president's busy trying to get people to, you know, worry about entitlement reform, that you know, some of these things can sort of sneak through without that Obama tarnish on them.
Do you think it was wise when the president, as part of the Social Security thing, he also said, we didn't talk about it, he said that Lindsey Graham from South Carolina was really the best looking senator. Do you think that was helpful to his cause?
I did a face plant there as well.
Yeah, okay, fine.
I saw the Newtown families. They were on 60 Minutes last night, and many of them vowed that they're not giving up, that this is going to be their lives' crusade. So that gave me some hope, too, because they were so moving to listen to these mothers and fathers. I'm just not sure that we're at the end of the rope as far as gun.
Look at the polling numbers. They're down 10% on gun control in the CBS poll.
I mean, that's a compelling emotional presentation, but it's still not enough to move those Republicans that have their heels dug in on the gun issue. They're just not going to. It doesn't matter how many people get killed, how many kids, adults, senior citizens,
movie
theaters.
But look at Colorado. Look at Colorado.
They're not going to budge.
Well, the lawmakers there in Colorado, because they have not one but two tragedies there, that's a pretty heavy gun state. That's a pretty rural state. Well, it's getting more urban.
That's because it happened there, though, Marjorie.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Exactly.
Well, and that's the thing. This is a battle that's being fought district by district. And in these individual districts, you've got the gun lobby strong. You've got this and the gun lobby's really good at grassroots. And you've got these people being afraid of being primaried. So you're just not going to get the numbers district by district. Certainly not. Assault weapons is obviously over. Background checks, I think there might – you keep hearing about some compromises. There might be a chance. But, you know, overall, I'm not expecting anything big.
Did you use the word primary as a verb there?
I did.
I love that,
by
the way, being primary. That actually – that's terrific.
Let's move on to the Senate race. You know, Steve Lynch, of course, the congressman from South Boston, I hope he's not going to Fenway Park today, because if he does, he's going to see this big banner flying over
Fenway Park.
He can
see it from
his
house in South Boston.
Yeah.
It's been everywhere.
Steve Lynch for evil oil empire. And it comes from this Thomas Steyer guy, this billionaire California hedge fund guy who sunk tons of money, very pro-environment guy, into a battle against Lynch, because Lynch, like Barack Obama, by the way, whom Steyer supports, but Lynch is for this Keystone pipeline coming down from Canada to Mexico. You talked to this fellow Steyer on the phone, Joanna Weiss.
I did. I talked to him a couple days ago. He was just coming off a fundraiser for the Democratic congressional delegation that where Barack Obama had been at his house. And he's taking this race. Basically, we've got the biggest race, or maybe the only race in the country right now. So this is the test lab for Tom Steyer's idea of how to combat big oil, big money that's been in politics for decades. He's saying, okay, Citizens United's here. This is a big money game. I got some money. I'm going to throw it at this, and I'm going to see if I can get voters to move on the environment. So this is less about, you know, Tom Steyer loving, or even really, I think, caring that much about Ed Markey as a candidate over Lynch. This is about the issue and getting the issue to the top of people's minds.
By the way, Edgar, our colleague, Edgar Herwick, is at outside Fenway. He said he just bumped into Lynch's campaign manager, who said that Stephen Lynch will be at Fenway at 1 o'clock today.
He's waving to the plane as it flies overhead.
My take on this, hundreds of thousands of dollars, whatever this Tom Steyer guy is spending, Dave Wedge from the Herald, I think this accrues to the benefit of Steve Lynch. Even if people want in this state, because they're environmentalists and believe Keystone XL may be bad for the environment, even if intellectually they're on the side of Markey's position, the flip side is when Lynch says there's this billionaire from out of state spending hundreds of thousands of dollars against this iron worker, meaning me, I think that resonates with people in an emotional sort of way that accrues to his benefit. No?
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. You know, we just went through the Scott Brown, Elizabeth Warren race where they swore off outside spending and all that stuff. And that worked well for both of them. You know, Scott Brown got crushed, but it worked well. And I think you're right. I mean, Steve Lynch has carved out this this populist image of this, you know, strap on your work boots. He, you know, his big campaign messages, I'm out there. I've worked on those towers you see down in the seaport for 17 years. And yeah, you know, most Massachusetts voters are going to look at this and say, who's this guy to come in here and tell us who to vote for?
Do you agree with that?
You know, I on some level I do. I mean, I do think there's a that, you know, there's also just sort of a general backlash to the idea of the establishment being behind Markey. You know, he really is the Democratic establishment candidate, and I think in some ways people like the underdog, and Lynch gets to play the underdog. Again, I think for Tom Steyer and the environmentalists who kind of asked him to come to Massachusetts, this is a longer game.
Right.
You know, this is really about bigger issues, and it's really about, you know, I sat in on a focus group that they held last week. And, you know, one of the things that they were trying to do was, again, get people to, you know, talk about the issues they care about. And nobody mentioned the environment. And these, you know, they you know, you ask them, how's the environment? Oh, it's dismal. It's awful. But it wasn't one of their top 1, 2, 3, 5, maybe even 10 concerns. These climate people think it is urgent. It is drastic. We need to get people talking about this now. So they just want to draw attention
to
the issue.
Well, Joanne, you talked in that column about how they showed them a story about Arkansas. Mm-hmm. Tell people what that was about.
Yeah, they showed a clip of some footage of the Arkansas oil spill. There was an oil spill last week. It was the same kind of Alberta tar sands oil that would be going in the Keystone pipeline.
Supposedly the dirtiest oil there is.
Dirty, yeah, dirty and corrosive and thick and gross. And it was, you know, spilled on people's houses. And these people in the focus group who'd been like, ah, the environment, they flipped out when they saw this video. I mean, they were just, they had this visceral reaction. Oh my God, I would never support that. If Lynch supports that, I'm going to ask him to change his mind. I mean, just having that footage in front of them changed their perspective.
You know, we're doing the debate. The Boston Herald is doing a debate tonight between Markey and Lynch. You can actually watch it at 7:30. We're going to stream it live at bostonherald.com. But I think I feel badly for – I'm rooting for Lynch. I've written – I like Steve Lynch. I don't know what Markey's been doing down there for all these years. I know he's good in the environment and all that kind of stuff. But anyway
– He brought us daylight savings time.
He brought us daylight savings time. That's right. And he also brought us a picture of the oil gushing up from underwater
when they had that terrible BP spill.
So, Lynch did pretty well in the last debate. But nobody paid any attention to it because it was the same day that the announcement broke about Tom and Nino. Mm-hmm. So they got absolutely croaked in the papers and absolutely no coverage. I'm hoping tonight there's going to be no other big story to compete with them, because I thought Lynch comes across to me as a much more natural politician.
Yeah, the problem is it's a special election. And as Joanna mentioned, you know, the Markey is clearly the establishment candidate. And who votes in these special elections? The establishment.
Right.
You know,
we should say every poll's got him up big time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the party, he's the party guy, just like Elizabeth Warren was. And, you know, he could crush Ed Markey in the debate tonight. And I just don't think it's going to move the polls much, because I think the Democratic establishment has made up their mind. Ed Markey's the guy. So
let's talk.
He's
got one quick
point. Steve Lynch has been underestimated in every race he's ever run.
Yep.
So I wouldn't count him out, because he is a great grassroots door knocking shoe leather type
of politician.
Great
ads.
And he does a good job. So the polls could be wrong on this one.
Speaking of ads, I don't know if I believe I'm right. As of today, at least as of the weekend, the only Republican with ads is Gabriel Gomez. And in light of the fact that every poll we've seen says nobody knows who any of these people are, Michael Sullivan, better known than the others, but not wildly well known. Gomez comes out with an internal poll on – we have no idea if it's phony or not. It has him in a virtual dead heat with Michael Sullivan, with Winslow 6 or 7 points behind. Whether the poll is legitimate or not, it seems to me that if Gomez, who's the wealthiest guy in the race, Dave Wedge, is the only guy who's able to afford more than scant television before it's over, the surprise of this race could be the least experienced guy who continues to make gaffes here and there, but has that perfect image, the Navy SEAL, the whole deal. We can say he's good looking, as
you
said, without getting in trouble.
We're not supposed to mention that, because we can't call the Attorney General good looking, so we can't call Gabriel Gomez good looking, although that's the strongest thing he's got going for him. He's got the Navy SEAL thing.
But the whole package.
If the Navy SEAL looked like Dan Winslow, it wouldn't be the same.
It's not preposterous to say this guy comes out of the pack.
Do any Navy SEALs look like Dan Winslow?
No.
I mean, Gomez, I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he's got that middle-of-the-road persona that he's fostering out there. So if he is the guy, he can kind of appeal to some of those Steve Lynch type of Democrats that, you know, the Scott Brown folks. I think a guy like Gabriel Gomez can do that. But Mike Sullivan's going to be tough to beat, I think.
You know, the conventional wisdom is that letter he wrote to Gomez wrote to Deval Patrick – hurts him badly in a primary if he makes it to a final. It helps because you praise the president, you work with Democrats, that sort of thing. You're making a face at me. You don't think he's got a shot in a primary.
I mean, I think we've seen this before a lot. The rich guy who seems to have the right profile, who can never quite cut it in politics. I mean, you know, first of all, this is a first-time candidate in a big, you know, race for a big office. It's not easy to run. It's a learning curve. So I always question what these guys can do, particularly the first time around. And I just, I don't know. She was not the private equity rich person.
Well, she was lecturing kids and taking questions. I think that probably helped her a lot because she was a lecturer.
In Harvard, you're talking about, and being a professor.
And being questioned. Yeah, you're performing it as a teacher.
And she had government experience. She'd been involved in the system. She had a whole background. She had friends in politics. I mean, that's different from the really rich guy swooping in and saying, hey, I look good. I was in the Navy.
So your point is I have no idea what I'm talking about. So let's just one last thing on the Senate race.
I'm with you, Jim, for the record.
You don't know what you're talking about either,
exactly.
Then.
Exactly.
Scott Brown goes to New Hampshire and drops, I guess, a mini bomblet, Dave Wedge. Maybe I'll run against Gene Chain. Here's my – and by the way, Emily Rooney had his wife on TV that night. And some people were saying, why didn't she say that he was – here's my take, knowing Scott Brown a little bit. That he didn't even have any intention of saying it until he said it. That Scott Brown basically was playing. Doesn't mean he wouldn't do it, but it was essentially a playful kind of thing. I have a home up here. I've been paying taxes 20 years. Maybe I'll do this here. Is there more to this than that?
I think you're probably right. I think, you know, knowing Scott, he's probably like, half joking. But
like
then
Henry,
he was
like, trying to get dates for his daughters?
Yeah. But then maybe a light bulb went off over his head like, 30 seconds later, and he was like, I guess I could actually run in New Hampshire. So I kind of agree with you. But the other thing is, it's very Mitt Romney of him. And remember, a lot of his advisors are Mitt Romney guys. You know, Fernstrom and Beth Myers. Those folks have all had some Scott Brown stuff. So you never know.
Mitt Romney has a house in New Hampshire, too, as we all know.
And a jet ski. And we know the rescue thing. One last race we want to talk about briefly with you guys. The conventional wisdom, Joanna Weiss, is because Dan Conley's got almost $900,000 in the bank that he can spend. He's the DA, obviously, of Suffolk County. He announced last week that he is the favorite. Does money really matter in a mayoral race as much as we know it does in statewide races and that sort of thing?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, first of all, there are so many candidates right now, and so many of them are really kind of geographically grounded, and it's all right now they're all sort of jostling for where they can build their base and what neighborhoods, again, if Menino's the model of sort of the, you know, meet everybody politician, this is about people meeting people and making these connections. This is not a TV ad kind of race.
It's a street race, and this is going to be a slugfest. And I think Dan Conley has a bit of an advantage with the money, where he can do more ads than the others. But this is really about who can galvanize folks in the neighborhoods. And you know, you got some Rob Consalvo, John Connolly. Mike Roskett's in, Felix Arroyo. I mean, those are all folks that, and Marty Walsh. I mean, they have a lot of support in the streets.
Is Marty Walsh formally in this race? He's a state representative.
He's formally in this race. Mike Ross and Felix Arroyo are the two that are on the fence, but all the rest I said are in.
You know, Larry Harmon had a very interesting op-ed in the Globe talking about how Menino goes after people that oppose him. I guess Larry Harmon opposed him himself, and he got the message, I am dead, to Boston Mayor Tom Menino. He criticized the mayor for misusing the City Hall-controlled nonprofit fund meant to beautify Boston. I guess he bought bracelets for some outgoing staffers and stuff. And then he went on to list other people, like a guy that helped Michael Flaherty that ran against Menino before, dead to the mayor. Sam Yoon ran against the mayor. Apparently had difficulty getting hired to nonprofits in Boston because he thought Yoon thought that they feared the mayor's wrath, these nonprofits who went to work for them. This is pretty – I always heard the Don Shafaro stories, how the developer Don Shafaro didn't get along with the mayor, so he's got four-foot potholes in front of International Place and stuff. But this is really pretty petty on the mayor's part, if this is true.
Larry told me this morning that he's been getting calls since, or you know, emails and calls since the Colin Rand saying, "Have I got a story for you?" I mean, I do think this is to some degree, you know, I mean, when Menino announced that he wasn't running again, there was a lot, you know, understandably and justifiably, a lot of sort of praise for what he's done,
including by your own editor, our Wednesday at 1 o'clock guest, Brian McGorry.
Oh,
go ahead.
and justifiable. But there is another side to Menino. He is a hardball kind of guy. I think he does take things personally. I think this is another part of his legacy that bears saying.
Yeah, but I have to say, when I read the Sam Yoon part of this, with all due respect to Sam, I thought it was pathetic. I mean, if you say on one day, up until November, whatever, of 4 years ago, I want to be the leader of your city, and then ultimately he teamed up with Michael Flaherty, but I'd be one of the leaders of your city. And then because there's a tough guy mayor, I move out of town.
Yeah.
'Cause, I mean, what is the line? Politics ain't beanbag. And the notion that Tom Menino is any more vengeful, in my opinion, than a lot of really tough big city mayors just doesn't cut it for me.
I mean, the Sam Yoon thing, I definitely agree with you about. He's a bit of a carpetbagger to begin with. But with as far as Mayor Menino goes, I've been at City Hall now covering it for 6-7 years. And you hear these stories all the time. You hear the stories about the nightclub guys. They don't donate to his campaign and the inspectors come in. You hear that stuff. But you're right. Happens in Chicago, happens in New York, happens everywhere. I don't think the mayor's any more vengeful than anyone else, but he does definitely have that side to him.
Okay, enough politics. You have 30 seconds, former TV critic from the Boston Globe, Joanna Weiss. Could you tell me what happened last night on Mad Men? I stayed up past we're going to talk about it at the end of the show with a TV blogger. What was going on there?
I had forgotten. It's been so long since it's been on. I'd forgotten how miserable all those people are.
They really
are. They are all so miserable. Was it that bad in 1968? Was it really that bad?
Well, the guy's mother died, and he says, I feel nothing. I don't care. She's gone. That's it. And then Don Draper, all he does is drink and get sick.
And then Betty had a weight gain, and she had am I allowed to say she looked terrible?
I'm not supposed to say that.
They called her in the Atlantic, they called her Fat Betty, is what they call her, so you can say that.
Jessica and I were up at 5 o'clock this morning with the baby, and she had DVR'd it, so I jumped in and watched a little bit, helping out. And all I could think of is that every time I see John Hamm on TV, he's in bed with a woman. Every time.
What
was his line about his New York? The woman said, the doctor's wife said, what's your New Year's resolution or something? What was his line?
I don't want to stop doing this.
Yeah, sure he does.
Yeah, staying up all night and drinking with strangers when he's in Hawaii. They managed to make a beautiful Hawaiian vacation look totally depressing. And then they were smoking marijuana. Advertising executives in 1967 smoking
marijuana?
I'm not
surprised by that at all.
I don't think so.
Johnny Walker. Yeah. Hey, Joanna Weiss from the Boston Globe and Dave Wedge from the Boston Herald. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you guys.
To see you both.
Thank you.
We're going to check in a couple of seconds with our guy on the scene at Fenway Park. And then we're going to join Derek Jackson to talk about March Madness and whether or not schools that don't do well graduating their kids should get thrown out of the competition.
Did you know that the best way to impress an Egyptian pharaoh was to bring him a keg of beer?
Walk like an Egyptian.
It's true. And you can satisfy your thirst for knowledge at the Taste of WGBH History of Beer event, Thursday, April 18th at 6 p.m. And don't worry, your taste buds won't be neglected. Sample some of history's finest brews and learn how beer has evolved over the years. To brew up your pair of tickets, visit us online at wgbh.org/events.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Boston Children's Hospital. From simple treatments to complex procedures, their community of care is accessible with suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians statewide. Boston Children's Hospital, until every child is well. An Antiques Roadshow, part adventure, part history lesson, and part treasure hunt. Which salvage yard save or garage sale grab is going to make someone a millionaire? Don't miss Antiques Roadshow, Monday at 8 on WGBH2.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Tonight, Louisville plays Michigan for the men's national championship of college basketball. And while all of us were filling out losing brackets, the Globe's Derek Jackson was busy filling out a different kind of March Madness bracket for the 17th straight year. Here to explain it all to us is Derek Jackson. Hey, Derek.
Hey, thanks, Jim.
Yeah, it is sort of an annual event. Yes, we expect this from Derek Jackson every year. But for people who don't know, I don't know who those could be, but for people who don't know, explain what it is you do, Derek.
Well, for years, I took the bracket and then just with the help of the graphic artist at the Globe, did a reverse, well, it turned out to be almost a reverse bracket, rearranging the schools by the graduation rates. And in particular, more recent years, I've done it by the black graduation rate because I feel in big time college sports, the black athletes are the canary in the coal mine as to whether a school is truly exploiting their athletes or really taking seriously making them student athletes.
And let's answer the question on everybody's mind before they even ask it. 57% African-American athletes at Michigan graduate in this recent thing you did, and Louisville, 80%. Some of the numbers are just staggering. Florida, zero.
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 I couldn't believe that. Yeah. That means none of the black basketball players that were recruited and are stars in the team graduate? None of them?
That's correct.
That
and when you spoke
staggering.
To the head of the NCAA, yeah. did you not?
Yes. Oh, a year and a half ago.
And, and what are they? I mean, it's one of these things. I pride myself in being able to understand what the other side would say on an issue. What possible defense can they make for having these schools make millions of dollars? Coaches make millions, while these kids, if they don't go to the pros, are going to be totally you-know-whatted at the end of 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I don't think they're offering much defense. And the fascinating thing about it is that, in fact, these statistics you just quoted are actually extremely generous because about 6 years ago, the NCAA allowed schools not to be penalized for athletes that left for the pros or whatever, as long as they were in, quote, good academic standing. Also didn't penalize them for students that went transferred out to other schools. So like Louisville, you mentioned Louisville. Louisville is 80% of their graduation rate's 80% by the more generous. But for the players that Louisville itself recruited and brought on campus, only 33% of the black players graduate. So the generosity hides even more sort of the rot underneath.
Does anybody care about this besides you? I mean, I'm serious.
Yes, they do.
I read it every single year, and I'm a huge college basketball fan. By the way, you're a Wisconsin kid, right?
That's right.
Were you upset when Wisconsin lost to Mississippi?
Absolutely.
Knew you would be. Okay.
And
I'm
also upset at the black male graduation rate at Madison. Oh, God. 14%.
Oh, my God.
You should not be participating in the bracket, Jim. You shouldn't have been betting. You shouldn't have been accepting your winnings. You should be boycotting March Madness if you were true to your principles here. But why is the disparity between black graduation and white graduation so great?
Well, I think for the schools that continue this disparity, they have made the choice to bring the purpose of the athlete is to make money for the school and win games. And there are many schools in recent years who have proven, and some of them were my whipping posts many years ago, there are schools that have chosen to improve. It's not really rocket science of getting a kid, sending the message that, your studies are to be taken seriously. I get asked a lot, by the way, critics of my work often say, well, isn't it the athlete's responsibility to graduate? I mean, and I say, yes, that's true up to a point, except for the fact that the reason we have college in the first place is because they're not fully formed people. And if they take their cues from athletic directors and coaches who make it clear that their number one priority is to win games and your purpose on this campus is to win for the front porch of the university, that's a very different message than saying you're going to graduate.
Our number is 877-301-8970. My position on this, I'd love to hear what you guys, particularly basketball fans, think, that if you don't reach a certain threshold over X number of years, you just shouldn't be able to play. And it seems to me if there was a financial penalty by not playing, then all of a sudden they would decide, these schools would decide that the education of these kids actually matters.
Derek, explain this to me because you're obviously the expert at this. I mean, I would assume a lot of the black athletes will come from tough neighborhoods and city schools where the schools are pretty crummy. But what I don't get is, okay, say you're a superstar for 4 years, you're not going to go to the NBA. Do some of these schools say, we'll give you extra time, we'll get you a tutor so that you can get the skills if you came from a lousy school system and you can't, if you're working basically full-time as a basketball player, I don't know how you're going to study anyway, but get that extra time to graduate. Is that there?
Sure. There are some schools that do that, and there are a lot that don't. And it's all on the whim and whimsy of the individual school. So, for instance, there are many years, the University of Cincinnati went for like several years straight at zero graduation rate. And then I got these letters.
That's embarrassing.
And I got these letters from alumni defending the school saying, but these players did graduate in like 10 years, you know, so. So it's a system where on one level, and Jim, you said something about, does anybody else care about it? What's interesting is that, I call it Arne Duncan,
Secretary of Education for Barack Obama.
Yeah, he cares about it.
Yeah, he does care about it. And I asked him, I said, should there start to be a penalty? The NCAA, and one of the few courageous things it's done, banned Connecticut from this year's tournament because their graduation rate was so abysmal. They couldn't not acknowledge that. But I asked the NCAA like a year and a half ago, Mark Emmert, the head of it, look, a huge percentage of schools still mask what looks like a overall good graduation rate with massive disparities of white graduation rates being really high and the black graduation rates being really low. And what are you going to do about those disparities for schools that don't change that behavior? And his answer at that point was, we're not going to do anything special. But Duncan, to his credit, said that if these disparities continue, that they should be sanctioned.
Well, his boss is basketball fan in chief, as we know. Our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to weigh in. I don't know if it's a glimmer of hope, but one guy who's got his head on straight, Tom McMillan, who was an All-American at Maryland, then became a went to the pros, then became a member of Congress from Maryland, right?
That's right,
Congressman?
Maryland.
You spoke to him, too. What is he trying to highlight, Derek Jackson?
Well, he's trying to highlight the he's very interested in the graduation rates. But he's also quite interested in the out-of-control salaries of coaches in these sports and the outrageous fact that assistant football coaches are now being paid more than the governors of states. Mm-hmm. So, the worst case is the Southeastern Conference, LSU, Alabama, Florida, that level. But I'm originally from the Midwest, and the Big Ten is the major conferences are all basically spending about $100,000 per athlete, which is three to five times more than the spending per regular student.
God, that is you mentioned that some schools, though, are doing it right. So what are those schools that are doing it right doing?
Sure. We have a pretty good example here locally, BC. Their graduation rates are very high, similar to Notre Dame's. I've gone to different schools over the years. They have academic support. The coach sends a message that I've known of cases where players have been kicked out of practice because they got a report from the guidance counselor or academic counselor that so-and-so got an F in that test. And there are schools that tell players, you don't get the grades, you're not practicing. And they get that message. If they get the message early, it works out. But many schools obviously don't.
If you're not outraged, let me read you one more piece from Derek's most recent piece on this. He's talking about McMillan, the guy we just mentioned, Arne Duncan. They recently reviewed the contracts of more than 50 football and basketball coaches in major conferences. He and Duncan, meaning McMillan and Duncan, co-authored an article for USA Today noting that athletic performance incentives in the coaches' contracts average $600,000 compared to $52,000 for incentives promoting academic performance. Now, obviously, flip those, and they basically said, hey, Rick Pitino, or hey, whoever the coach of your alma mater, Wisconsin, is, you're going to make an extra $500,000 if you graduate 90% of your team. My guess is they'll graduate 90% of your team. If there's money in it for these people, they'll perform, no?
Yeah. I mean, I think expectations are everything. Are there athletes who are in schools that the academic load is over their head? Sure, and those players should probably play at Division II or something like that. But there's a huge blame. I'm glad you brought it up because this is a huge blame to lay at the feet of college presidents and boards of trustees who are so. We obviously saw the sad ultimate end of that at Penn State, where that can go, and we also just got saw Rutgers where. The athletic director allowed the coach to continue coaching, even though he had seen the tape of abuse by the coach. So there's this level of sports that we have in a very broad concept that we have elevated to some, godlike level that too many presidents, too many boards of trustees look the other way.
Does this happen in football, too?
Oh, it's
Just as bad?
It's maybe worse.
It's worse. Okay, that's
right. Hey, Derek, last question for me. This, every year I look forward to this, and when it's not in for a few days, I get aggravated. So I'm so glad it's here yet again. Has anybody tracked what happens to the non-graduating African-American who does not make it into the NBA or the NFL? Has anybody looking at that work, what the real consequence of this obscene policy is in March Madness and BCS football?
You get, anecdotal stories, enterprising feature writers, sports mm-hmm. feature writers who will do something on a particular individual athlete or, where are the Fab Five from Michigan? Where are they at today? Although a lot of them did play pro ball. I think the large aggregate story is yet to be told about, what's happened to all these players that did not graduate.
Okay, you've done this 17 years in a row. Last question, for real. How many years will you do it before the NCAA actually does something? Come on, do Nostradamus.
He'll be from the great beyond. That's
why
what
are we
happen.
Laughing? Derek Jackson, it's fabulous work, as it is every single. It's great to see you.
Derek Jackson is a columnist for the Boston Globe, and it's a great – you're doing a great service here, Derek Jackson. Okay. By
Google this
story.
Thing, by the way. By it's Googling. Called March Madness Brings Vast Graduation Gaps. It's great.
Derek, thank you so much for coming in and being with us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, here's what we want to know. Are you going to Fenway Park by any chance?
No.
Okay. Did you call in sick, the rest of you, because you are going to Fenway Park? Well, those of you who did schlep to work, we'll bring you a taste of opening day, both from inside and outside the ballpark. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio on opening day. I'm Jim Browder. She is Marjorie Egan. Now for our, I guess we can call it our exclusive outside-inside coverage of opening day at Fenway. In a couple of minutes outside will be Boston Public Radio's Edgar B. Herrick III. In a few minutes, he'll answer the question, are there two kinds of Bostonians, those who get tickets to opening day and those who don't? But first, inside is the co-author with Terry Francona of the terrific bestseller, Francona, The Red Sox Years. Joining us on the phone from inside Fenway is the Globe's Dan Shaughnessy. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Dan.
How are you guys doing?
Great.
We're
thanks
great.
For calling.
Thank you very much for calling in. So, Dan, you had a great front page story today. Redemption Tour comes home Monday afternoon. It's here. The Redemption Tour has started, I guess. But I wonder, as a guy who's covered the sports for so many years in Boston, you talk about the anger of the fans last year. I know it wasn't a good year. And now we're a little bit more hopeful because they've done well in the beginning of the season. Is this a little over the top? Do you think we're too overly involved? I mean, anger, tragedy, ecstasy, disaster. What do you think?
Well, you've lived here your whole life. You understand how it works, Margie. I mean, there's a lot of passion. We overreaction. We exaggerate victory and defeat. I mean, everything is larger pictures here, broad strokes. But the fact is, there is passion. So, yes, people were very mad last year. Worst team in a generation. Worst team in 47 years. The anger was palpable, and the Red Sox spent the whole winter saying, please don't hate us. And here they are this spring, and now they turn it into four wins in six games. They finally come home. The weather's turned. People have to be warm again. And so now we're exaggerating how good they are. We don't know how good they are. It's a very small sample, but people love baseball here. They care about the Red Sox, so they will be hard on them. It's like your children. You're hard on them when it's bad, and you love them too much when it's good.
You left the other big thing out, 2 KM francs for the price of one, Dan Shaughnessy. Hey, Dan, so they come home 4-2. They win a series in New York. They win a series in Toronto. Toronto's supposedly quite good this year. Is this real, or is it Memorex, or is it too easy to figure it out, too early to figure it
out?
Well,
yeah, it's the latter. I'm certainly, again, you're talking about 162 games. You got six of them under your belt, and they've won 4 out of 6, which is great. Very small sample. Doesn't tell you a lot, but the sign, all you can do is play the games that are there and do what you can do in the games in front of you. And you can't ask a whole lot more than what they did do in those six games. So those signs are good. They appear to care about each other more. Guys are certainly friendlier. I think the ownership is a little reaching out to fans. And you mentioned the dogs and the beer and those kinds of things. And I think trying to tell the truth more often and don't look at us on Monday and tell us that it's Thursday. You know, I think that people they're too sharp around here for that.
Speaking of friendlier, if I recall correctly, and I know you correct me if I'm wrong, Dan Shaughnessy, after your book came out, you asked a couple of questions at a press event of Larry Lucchino, and I believe his response was a rather terse no comment to everything you asked. Is he talking to you now, or is he still in this funk over your fine work with Terry Francona?
Apparently the latter. They're still mad about the book. I understand that. But, you know, they're mad at the ex-manager. It didn't end well with Terry Francona here. They're mad at Theo Epstein, who, you know, parlayed it into a $19 million contract in Chicago and got out of town. And it's just, you know, they had a great 7.5 years of Terry Francona here. The book frames that. It kind of explains the arc of when things were great and how they ended up not so great. It's all there. I understand they don't like it. And Larry, I'm hoping we can argue about it at some point. I'm always up for a good argument. And Larry's, he's Italian. He gets into that too. And in his history, he's always been willing to go eyeball to eyeball and yell at each other. And that's what I'm hoping we can get to.
Well, some people may not like it, Dan, but Francona, the Red Sox years, has been on the New York Times bestseller list for like 7 weeks in a row. So obviously, people just in Boston, people all across the country are into this as a baseball story. What do you think? Is it because of the Red Sox? I mean, I know you're a brilliant writer, Dan Shaughnessy. Francona's a great guy. But this has had nationwide appeal.
It's a very compelling story because the Red Sox, as we know, if you travel around, you can go anywhere on the planet now. The Red Sox hats are there. They really are a global team, and that's part of the story of Francona, is that they spread the brand. They went to Japan, and their TVs, their ratings are all worldwide, and we hear from people in Vietnam watching the games, and it's just they're really a global entity. And the book debuted at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list, and I still have all the Red Sox officials saying, well, we haven't read it, so nobody's read the book, but somehow it ended up in that list. So I can't quite balance the two things.
That's pretty good, I guess. In other words, Dan Shaughnessy, they're not going to admit if they've read the book or they haven't read the book. So how's the guy this year, Farrell?
Oh, we like him. I mean, you know, I think that he worked here for 4 years. That's important. And one of the things that you come across when you read the Francona book is how hard it is to do this job. We know it's hard. He did it for 8 years. There's a learning curve here that involves multiple voices of ownership, you know, stat guys coming at you, media guys coming at you, fans who really care. It's a lot to take on at once. And Bobby Valentine is as smart as he is. I think it's just asking a lot for anyone to walk in here and understand all the multiple responsibilities and voices and facets of this job and to keep all the brush fires submerged. That didn't happen last year. Francona did it well for 8 years. I think Farrell will be capable of doing that. He's a grown up. He worked here for 4 years, and I think he knows how to handle all the situations that arise when you manage the Boston Red Sox.
So how are the kids? One of the kids, who I guess is in his second year, hits 3 home runs yesterday, almost hits 4. This Jackie Bradley Jr., while his batting average is not great, he's had a fairly decent start. What's the word on the kids, Dan Shaughnessy?
Well, Middlebrooks, you know, played half a year last year and broke his wrist, and he came out of the gate in a good way, hit the 3 home run game yesterday in Toronto. No Red Sox players ever hit 4 in a game, so it was pretty dramatic to see that. Bradley is not playing today. He'll be on the bench at the start. There's a tough left-hander for Baltimore and novice playing left field. And, you know, Bradley, there's going to be, you know, it's hard to hit the big leagues after as little experience as he's had in the minors. So he probably will go back to the minors when David Ortiz reappears next month. But in the meantime, you know, if you win games, there won't be as much clamor for Bradley. The other kid is Jose Iglesias, who's hitting over 500, had a great start. A lot of infield hits, a lot of bunt hits. He's tremendous with the glove. And fans want to see these kind of, you know, new names, young guys, not making that much dough, hungry guys playing for the Red Sox.
We're talking with Dan Shaughnessy from the Boston Globe, author of the 7 weeks in a row bestseller, Francona, the Red Sox Years. Dan Shaughnessy, I've never been to opening day, and I feel a little bit like I'm kind of a loser because I've never been.
You are.
But thank you. But there's a real star-studded mover and shaker cast there today, right? I mean, if you're like a power broker, and you're probably too busy covering the game to notice this, Dan, but you must have heard this through the grapevine. This is like a big Boston power broker show of force today, no?
Well, I think certainly in the last decade, it has been that. And when you had the championship team in 2004 and 2007, and, you know, Dr. Charles Steinberg was doing his Cecil B. DeMille thing over here on opening day, you know, you always had a lot of kind of A-lister, big-name things. And I think they're dialing that back a little bit this year because expectations are low, and no one expected the team to go 4-2 out of the gate. And I think it'll be a little more subdued. The theme this year, you know, it's a very sweet, connecting theme, is with the Jimmy Fund. There's 60 years of concert between the Red Sox and this children's charity. And there's really nothing like it in all of professional sports to have a team attach itself to one charity and do so much great things over the course of six decades. So they're going to emphasize that today. That'll make things a little bit more muted. You're going to have patience on the field with ex-players, and it'll be a very patient thing. But not quite the, like the Rolling Stones wheeling in terminally at Logan and smashing away on center field. I don't think it'll be quite that flashy.
Yeah, I think I read in your column that the Jimmy Fund chorus is going to sing the national anthem.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes, and I think that they'll unfurl that giant flag in left field, and I expect you'll have patients coming out of the field from all the decades with players from all the decades. I think it's going to be very tasteful.
That's pretty great, actually.
But Dan Shaughnessy, thank you so much for taking a couple of minutes being
with
us today.
Thanks.
on opening day, because I know it's a big day for you, Dan. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Anytime to hang with you guys. Take care.
Good to talk to you, Dan.
And again, it's a great book. Like I said, massive bestseller. Frank Cohn of the Red Sox Years. Dan Shaughnessy wrote it with Terry Francona, and it's all about his triumphs and not-so-triumphant moments when he was running the Red Sox.
I want you to know that you made it through the 10 minutes with Dan Shaughnessy. You're always saying, I don't know anything about baseball. I'm not a sports fan.
I don't.
You said Farrell, referring to the manager.
John Farrell.
No, it's very impressive. By the way, you can check out photos and videos from opening day on our website. If you're not lucky enough, like some, to go to opening day, you can go to WGBHnews.org. Now, Shaughnessy was on the inside. On the outside, which is where I sort of feel people like us belong, Marjorie, is our colleague
Brookline Avenue
from Boston Public Radio, Edgar B. Herwick III. What's it like outside the gates, Edgar?
Yeah, how are we doing, guys? You took the words out of my mouth. I was thinking, here's a true outsider now to follow up Dan Shaughnessy coming in here. Well, he just used the word subdued to talk about the opening day ceremonies that are going to be happening in the ballpark. And I think, actually, for as exciting as it is out here, and it is exciting, I think subdued is a word that's coming out of a lot of people's mouths. There's certainly a lot of folks here. The bustle has picked up, no question, in the last maybe half hour, 45 minutes. Cigarettes are being smoked, beers are being consumed, sausages are being eaten. All of that is happening. But when you talk to people, they sort of feel like, compared to the last few opening days, it's a little bit more reserved out here right now.
Really? How so? I mean, Dan Shaughnessy was joking about the Rolling Stones arriving at Logan Airport. But, I mean, do you mean it's just not this triumphant swagger that everybody had last year anticipating another World Series opportunity? Is that it?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think there's a little bit less swagger. And I think if you talk to some of the folks, which I have, that are sitting in the bars who have been doing this for many years, and this is something you hear repeatedly. A lot of people do this as a tradition. So, I talked to some group of guys who are sitting in the cask and flagon. They've been doing this for 15 years. I talked to another group of guys that were on Game On, sitting at a bar. They've been doing this for about 9 years.
Well, wait a second. Edgar, they've been drinking for 15 years or they've been going to opening day for 15 years?
I'll tell you what. Based on the information I got from them, it was tough to tell which one it was. But they're having a good time. But they said, compared to other years, there's just not as many people here. The guy who was working the door at Copperfields, which is another bar down the street a little bit, he said he's been doing it for 15 years. He said there's just not as many people out. So I don't think it's as much that people aren't excited, because when you talk to them, people are psyched about this season. As you heard Sean, as he said, they're excited about some of the younger players. They're excited that they came out of the gate strong, but there's just not as many people. Now, some of them are saying it's a good thing. I've heard the word pink hats thrown around a lot here, saying, there's not as many pink hats around as there have been in the past.
Hold on, Edgar. For those who don't know, please, what are pink hats?
So the pink hats are a term that have grown in the last few years for the Johnny-come-lately fans who have come to the Red Sox in recent success. Obviously they went 86 years without a championship, and as soon as they won a championship, you saw the interest in the team swell. The pink hats, of course, refers to the marketing outreach and the beginning of moving away from a traditional baseball cap with the Red Sox colors to reaching out with a pink a baseball cap with the Red Sox insignia on it. So it's sort of a disparaging term for Johnny Come Lately fans.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. If you would call in sick to work today and lie about it to get to the Red Sox on opening day, please call us and tell us if you have done it in the past. And if you feel like you're kind of a loser because you've never been there in your entire life, and the one time you were there, you sat in the bleachers behind a post.
Edgar, one of the things I don't quite get, talking to Shaughnessy, talking to you, and talking to other people I know who are diehard Red Sox fans, to me, it's a beautiful day. It's 60-some degrees. It's sunny.
Is it nice out?
It's gone up to 61 or 62 degrees. It's sunny out. It's a beautiful opening day. I once asked, in probably the single worst interview I've ever experienced in my whole life, I asked Theo Epstein. I said, no, seriously, I said,
Jim and Theo, we didn't quite hit it off.
I asked him, I said, how great, do you ever want to just go into the right field bleachers with a beer on a hot, sunny day and just take in the game? And he literally said to me, it's unprofessional to drink while I'm working. But putting that aside, the joy of being outside, you walk up the ramps, you see the green field, you see the dirt around the base paths, you have to get to have a beer in the sun. I mean, it's pretty great, isn't it?
It's incredible. And you know what? You don't even have to go as far as getting inside of the stadium. Just to be out and around here. In fact, the first family that I talked to, when we were coming down here, I got on the T, we got on the green line, and as soon as we got onto the train, the conductor came on the loudspeaker and he said, we're going express to Fenway. People erupted into applause.
I love that.
And I'm standing next to a family of Red Sox fans, right? And I start talking to this guy. I said, have you gone to opening day before? And he says, yeah, we've been doing this for a number of years now. He's got a son who looked to be about 6, 7 years old. And I said, well, are you going to the game? He said, no, we don't go to the game. We just go down and hang out around the outside and take in the atmosphere.
I think that's great.
And it's totally great. And on top of it, believe this, Jim. So I said, well, you guys live around here. He says, no, we're from out of town. I said, where are you from? He says, Denmark.
Wait a second.
Denmark?
No, listen to me. I say, you're from Denmark, but you live here? He said, no, actually, we live in Sweden. But we come to America. I went to school here. I come back every year, and we time it for Red Sox opening day. And I take my son down, and we stand outside in the sun, and we eat some sausages, and we watch all the people walk by, and people are selling programs, and yipping and yelling, and people from radio stations have signs, and there's planes flying overhead. And as you said, right now people are shedding their coats right in front of me. The sun is out.
I love it.
It's a beautiful day. Spring is here. Baseball is here. And this town's coming alive right now out here on Lansdowne Street.
Let's take a call or two if we can at 877-301-8970. Edgar B. Herwick III, is it opening day? Well, he's sort of at opening day.
He's outside opening day.
I've got the outside perspective. The outsider's look.
Yeah. Okay, we got Richard from Framingham on the line. Oops,
we
lost
Richard.
Richard from Framingham on the line.
Richard, give us a buzz. 877-301-8970. We lose Edgar, too, or just Richard? We didn't lose.
No, I'm still here, I think. Hey, guys, can you hear me?
Yeah.
You know why the guy from Denmark probably doesn't have any tickets? Because, I mean, he's got enough money to fly here with the whole family. He probably doesn't realize you have to go to Ace Ticket or StubHub to get any tickets for this game.
That's right.
Because opening day is sold out, right?
Well, except it's sold out, and they're predicting that the sellout streak is going to end sometime this week. That's what I wanted to ask you. Are scalpers as active this opening day as we're used to them in the past, or is that more muted too?
No, I mean, definitely you're walking past, there's a lot of people saying tickets, tickets, tickets. But the thing is, with scalpers get active whether there's a lot of tickets or few tickets. You know what I'm saying? Because they're buying and selling, they're sort of trading them off. So, but when I talk to the fans, you know, some of the guys and people who I've talked to, they picked tickets up yesterday on StubHub. And, you know, they said they didn't really pay that much over face value. You know, in the past, some of the folks that I talked to said they, you know, expect to pay up to 3 times face value for tickets to opening day in the secondary market. But they were getting them for just a small markup. So, you know, certainly it is sold out, and I think they anticipate tomorrow, the next game is going to sell out, but Wednesday, I believe, was what they were targeting as possibly the sellout streak ending. That's something that is going to happen soon. So, again, it is just there are fewer people right now. One of the guys who works at the stadium I was talking with for a little while, he's been doing it for about 6, 7 years, and he said, you're really going to know in terms of how busy the season is going to be here during home games, he said, in about 2 weeks. He said, look, there's a lot of excitement early in the season. Opening day always sells out. But he said in about 2 weeks, he's going to know, just based on the size of the crowds, whether or not they're going to be selling games out left and right or whether there really is going to be less interest in the Red Sox this year.
Let's try for Ann in Dorchester. Ann, are you there? You're on the phone with us. And Edgar B. Herwick III is outside Fenway. What do you think, Ann?
Hi, Ann.
Hello.
Hi. Shoot. Go.
Well, howdy. I'm sorry, I'm confused because I was listening to the radio.
Oh, that's okay.
I just wanted to say that Edgar B. Hurwitz just said what I adore about Fenway Park and why I've been a fan since I've been 6 years old and listening to games under my pillow at
night.
Why is
that?
It's just so gorgeous. And it's and especially when you come out onto the field, like you described, and see the green grass and the blue sky, and it's just no place else in the world like Fenway Park. And
so I guess you don't want them to move it, like Kevin Paul was talking about in his Gold Globe column.
Freaking out during that conversation the other day. I was going, oh, it sounds like they're actually getting serious about this, and I would be in front of bulldozers. I'll tell you, I'm just, I'm 65 years old, and I would just link arms with anybody who would also not want them to tear down.
I think you're going to be 165 before you have to worry about it, Anne, so I think you're safe. Thanks for the call.
And by the way, Anne, I was talking to Dan Shaughnessy about this, and of course he's been covering the Red Sox for years. He thinks that there's not a chance with the money that the new ownership has sunk into
course.
It and the improvements that have been made. And it is physically, I mean, it may be rickety in parts, but it is physically a million times better, especially with the green monster on top of it.
Anne,
thank you for the call, Anne. Let's go to Nancy, who's driving. What do you think, Nancy?
I just wanted to say that I grew up, we've had season tickets. My brother used to actually, my mom would pull him out of school so he could go to opening day with my grandfather. I now have a 9-year-old son who's with my brother right now. I pulled him out of school today.
Oh.
I have no problem with it. And my brother flew up to Virginia. He does it every year. And this is something about opening day.
Do the teachers give you a hard time or not, Nancy?
You know what? My son has a real tough teacher this year. I sent her an email this morning. I said, you know, he's going to be leaving early to go to the game. And I kind of thought she was going to bust me for it. And her first line was yay for him. So totally cool.
Yeah, it's because she wanted to be at the game, too. Nancy, thank you for the call. Hey, Edgar, is this, I assume being outside, you were not able to participate in the 2-for-1 KM Frank deal or the $5 beer. Is that correct?
That is correct. My official line is, that is correct. I have not had any hot dogs or beer.
How can you do that?
You know why he's asking you that? Because he wants you to run in and get him a couple, 2-for-1, and bring him back. Yeah.
Bring it back to the studio. I got you, Jim.
Hey, Edgar, when you come back, corner me, and I will tell you the story that Marjorie is kind enough not to tell about how I almost got arrested for buying a sausage outside the stadium and trying to bring it in. And it was actually only Marjorie's intervention that saved me. It's a long story.
One last quick question for me, Edgar. If you were to buy a ticket from a scalper, have you gotten any idea of what your price range would be today?
I have no idea what the price range would be today. It would probably be, I would think, a little bit over face value.
Yeah.
That said, if I waited till the game started, obviously, if you wait till the second, third inning, if they still have tickets, you can probably get it for face value or even less, I would think. So if people are hanging around and want to grab a ticket, I think they're certainly available here. You know, it's a great team. Whether you have a ticket or not, this is it's definitely special.
And Edgar, also, you can just tell your friends what tonight and tomorrow. You can just say, I was at opening day, and hope they don't ask a follow-up question, you know?
Absolutely.
It's okay. It's okay, Edgar. Thank you. Thank
Edgar,
you very
thanks.
Much for checking in. I watched the Bruce Springsteen concert from Brookline Avenue as well, so it's not that bad.
No, actually, it's true. You went opening night, and the second night you sat outside
in
your car.
It was great. B. Herwick is the third as a reporter for WGBH. Dan Shaughnessy, whom we talked to earlier, is a sports columnist and writer for the Boston Globe, and his latest book, the bestseller, Frank Kona, The Red Sox Years. Up next, Reverend Eugene Rivers III joins us for Open Mic. Keep your dial with us on 89.7 WGBH for our conversation with Gene.
EasyPass and other automatic highway payment tools make commuting easier for drivers, but they mean something very different for toll collectors manning the booths.
Some jobs are just outsourced or technology takeover. In this case, technology is taking over.
I'm Sarah Gardner. Another case of a disappearing job. Next time on Marketplace from APL.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's new showroom in Natick or at doverrug.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio on opening day. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as he does every Monday at 1 o'clock, is the co-founder of the 10-Point Coalition. He is Reverend Eugene Rivers. Hey, Gene, nice to see you.
Greetings, smart people.
Hey, before we talk about this rising star in the Republican Party, I want to ask you, we just had Derek Jackson on from the Boston Globe for 17 years. He's
brilliant
been doing
guy.
His own kind of brackets, pointing out that the graduation rate in a lot of these teams that are superstars, the NCAA, is lousy.
Yeah.
A lot of debate that they should be thrown out if they can't produce a reasonable graduation rate, or what do you think?
Well, it's true. But in contrast to what? The reality is I'm a poor kid from the Bronx. This is my shot, right? Now, I should get a better education. I probably won't, based on how the system functions. So it's a very difficult thing because on the one hand, this is the only opportunity these kids have to get anywhere. I mean, anywhere. I mean, just out the hood, right?
Right.
So do we keep them in the hood where their lives will be completely miserable, or do we, as Derek has done admirably, lobby to try to get some sanity on what essentially is a business. I mean, when you look at the numbers, right, the universities now, can you imagine that the University of Ohio or Kentucky have budgets just for their athletic departments that are larger than the entire colleges?
Yeah, but when you say it's a business, in most businesses, everybody gets paid.
Right.
And in this case, the workers, for lack of a better expression, who are the ones that bring celebrity and millions of dollars to the schools, don't get paid. They get a scholarship. But, you know, the problem is the vast majority of these kids with starry eyes and promises from recruiters,
absolutely,
you're going to play in the NBA.
Yeah,
virtually none of them make it to the NBA.
None of them make it
so
to the NBA.
So they don't make it to the NBA. They have a graduation rate at Florida of zero.
Yeah. That's incredible.
At University of Michigan, which is a great school. This is blacks I'm talking about.
I know.
57%.
It's an academic plantation system.
But it's so clear. If it turns out NCAA said the following, said you have 4 years, whatever, you have 4 years to bring your graduation rates nationally up to 80%. Anybody in 4 years that can't bring them up to 80%, you can't play,
absolutely,
which means you lose millions and millions and you have really angry alumni. Everybody's going to have an 80% graduation rate, aren't they?
That's right. That's absolutely correct. I mean, it's tragic. Because you've got these kids, they don't get paid. It's an academic plantation system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we just heard a story just a couple of days ago about the poor guy. What happens if you get injured, right?
Yeah.
If you get
Kevin Ware from Louisville,
And you get booted, dude, you've got no – they're not taking care of you.
How about that gymnast in the Olympics that was from the Bronx? You mentioned the Bronx.
Yeah.
He was trying to get all these endorsements, do well in the Olympics so he could help his parents who were in dire financial straits. And, of course, the kid did not do well. And that was no Wheaties box for him.
In all seriousness, we talk about what priorities are.
He's a black kid. He's a black kid, right?
Yes.
You know, the one black male gymnast. I remember him.
Why is this not a priority? I mean, I know for a fact, you work a lot with young athletes in the community.
Yeah.
I've been with you when a couple of young kids you got into boxing. Why isn't this a priority? I mean, the reality is it's not an isolated thing. Admittedly, it's not zillions of people.
So few kids get there anyway.
But the other part of it is, frankly, these are poor black kids and they don't matter. At the end of the day.
But they theoretically matter to you, don't they?
Of course they do. So I've got like maybe a 500,000 different issues that affect black kids, right? So, for example, today in the paper, there's a story about black girls and violence. The Herald ran a story a couple of weeks ago about my concerns around that, right? This issue of black athletes and academics is a big deal. But there's so much money. There's certain things you don't touch because the money's too big. And you get squashed like a bug if you try to make noise about it. And this is one of them. For you to be the voice crying in the wilderness about the fact that these kids are put on an academic plantation with no payoff when you're going up against the kind of money that you're going to get, you don't win that one.
Well, one guy who could win this, as I said to Derek Jackson, it seems to me Barack Obama is the biggest basketball fan in America, could win this in about a minute and a half, couldn't he?
And his education guy, Arnie Duncan seems to be concerned about.
Okay.
You know, you could just have tutors for the last 2 years. You play ball for 4 years, then you spend year 5 and 6 because these kids don't have time to study anyway. All they're doing
is
playing basketball.
That's right.
But let's move on to something else.
Okay.
There's this new rising star.
Who's a buddy of yours?
I've seen him all over television. Dr. Benjamin Carson. You're laughing.
Yes.
Tell us about Dr.
Well, before
Benjamin
he tells
Carson.
Us about him, let's do it. Carson has had some very good days and so not so
few
very
bad
good days.
Yes,
one
has.
Of his good days, well, I guess good in terms of high profile. Last month, Carson is at the National Prayer Breakfast. He's sitting next to Barack Obama, and he takes a swipe at Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act. Listen to Dr. Carson.
Here's my solution. When the person is born, give them a birth certificate, an electronic medical record, and a health savings account, to which money can be contributed pre-tax from the time you're born to the time you die. When you die, you can pass it on to your family members so that when you're 85 years old and you got six diseases, you're not trying to spend up everything. You're happy to pass it on, and there's nobody talking about death panels.
Now, he became a darling of conservatives immediately after that. And incidentally, he's the head of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins. This is a big-time kind of guy. Well, that was a good day for him, at least in conservative circles. Here's a day where he had a little bit more trouble. He's talking to Sean Hannity last month, and the issue was gay marriage. Listen to what Dr. Carson had to say.
No group, be they gays, be they NAMLA, be they people who believe in bestiality, it doesn't matter what they are, they don't get to change the definition.
Be they NAMLA, yeah. That's the North American Man-Boy Love Association, for those that don't know, be they bestiality. He subsequently apologized primarily for embarrassing his university, Johns Hopkins. You know this guy. Is that? Yes. I mean, people are talking about him as a presidential candidate in 3.5 years. Is that a death blow, this Hannity interview, or does he survive this?
It's probably a death blow. Obviously, it was the wrong thing to say. Regardless of what you believed, that's not a cow pie you step in. That's not a good career move, right? Well,
like this guy, don't you?
Oh, no, he's a decent person.
What do you like about him?
One, he's a decent person, which is, actually doesn't count for much in public life.
But he's pediatric neurosurgeon. Everybody loves pediatricians.
Right, exactly. He's a decent person, except for that rather remarkable quote from Sean Hannity, right? I mean, that may be more a function of who he was talking to, sort of dragged the IQ down, right? But, yeah. And aside from that, he's a very admirable, respectable. He's got a great narrative, you know, he kind of rags from the hood to pediatric neurosurgeon kind of story. He's got a book, a movie. And he is essentially the Barack Obama of the right. I mean, that's basically who he is. In a nutshell, this is the hard right's Barack Obama throw up, right?
Yeah.
And they're going to throw him against the wall and see if he sticks. Right? I mean, that's, you know, you had Herman Cain, right? You had Cain, and he's there for
nine,
a minute, right?
Nine,
right? Then and now you've got it. And in fact, and so you've got a pediatric neurosurgeon that you throw up against the wall, hope he'll stick, and hope that they can't dig up more brilliant formulations like this NAMLA business, which was really very unfortunate.
You know, Herman Cain, if he hadn't constantly talked about
nine,
might have done better, because he was very charismatic, very smart.
Well, I think he had another problem.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, a few women. I don't know.
I don't know.
Those blondes will do it to you every time.
Well, I'm not sure. There's so many presidents with so many blondes. I'm not sure if that's disqualifying.
Yeah. Gene Rivers, we spent last week talking about how, at least you were talking about how the likelihood of an African-American or a person of color becoming a major player in the mayoral race was quite small.
Yeah.
Other than Ben Carson, on the national front, who are the people of color who are or have become or could become darlings of the conservative wing of the Republican Party? Are there any?
Listen, the best shot they had was Ben Carson. But as I say, with the Hannity, because that's irresistible, right? He's the sharpest. He's got all the credentials.
Went to Harvard.
Squeaky clean, yep. Got a wife, no girlfriends, you know, no foolishness. And so that's about it. I mean, because see, the thing that's interesting about your question is that I was actually with a group of these cave people last week. And I said, listen, how was it that you guys are just like completely intellectually brain dead? It's actually extraordinary. I mean, you have nothing, right?
Who are you people? Who are you talking to?
I was talking to some folk from the Bradley Foundation, which is a very conservative, foundation. You know, it tries to be the MacArthur of the right, right? And I'm talking to them. I said, this is absolutely astounding. And I said, the thing that's amazing to me in 2013 is that you look at when the last time the Republicans got really squashed is 64, when Lyndon Johnson steamrolled Barry Goldwater, right? Now, you had a handful of characters who were prepared to do the long march. Bill Buckley, William Rusher, extremely smart, full of piss and vinegar, you know, and they mounted an intellectual assault. The left suffered from overreach. Nixon squeaks by, and then you've got this long run. You have nothing today. So what's interesting is that Republicans are in an intellectual crisis, which is actually deeper than liberals who are just happy beyond belief, right? It's a very they've got a philosophic and directional crisis that they're not going to overcome in short order.
Are black voters in this country willing to crack their minds open to a conservative African-American candidate? Put it aside, and it's hard to put it aside.
Yeah.
For the moment, let's put aside the Hannity comments. Could someone like Carson, who's got a very conservative orthodoxy as part of his shtick, could he have appeal, or are African-Americans in this country so connected to the Democratic Party that there's virtually nothing right now that can break him loose?
Let's sharpen that formulation and put Hillary Clinton up against Ben Carson.
Mm-hmm.
Black people love Hillary Clinton,
mm-hmm.
right? They like Hillary Clinton. They like Hillary, right? I mean, like Hillary, right? And my sense is that there's not a wedge issue which would be deep enough, right? Something would really have to go bad. I mean, someone would have to slip. She'd have to lose her mind and say the N-word.
Right.
Right, before you'd get...
Her husband is forgiven
Oh, yeah, misdeaths. No, Bubba, we love Bubba, right? Okay. We love Bubba, right? The new and improved Bubba, right? So my sense is that's not likely. I'll tell you someone who was actually very attractive, Colin Powell.
Very attractive.
Colin Powell, and there was no wuss, there was no, right?
What's a conservative part of him, though? He's pro-choice, is he not?
Yeah, he's pro-choice.
He's pro-choice. He's voted for Barack Obama
two times.
You've supported a lot of Republicans.
No, that's not true.
Yeah?
I work with a lot of Republicans. I was smarter than that.
Didn't you support George Bush?
The younger. Yeah, and I work with him. Let's tell the whole story.
Okay.
I work with Bill Clinton. In fact, the faith-based initiative actually began in the Clinton administration, not the Bush administration, right? So I worked with him. I worked with Gore. Gore had the election stolen, right? Had Gore prevailed, right, I would have worked with him. And so my thing's always been bipartisan. It's never been a Republican thing. I'm too smart for that. I'm a black dude in America, right? So I can't be ideologically inflexible.
You weren't with Scott Brown, Reverend Rivers?
Oh, no. I like Scott Brown, and I also like Elizabeth Warren.
Just checking.
No, I love everybody.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm postpartum. Now, watch this now. With Barack Obama, my black president, said I got to be postpartisan. Right? So to take a page out of your president, the brother's postpartisan.
Okay. Eugene Rivers, with us every Monday at 1 o'clock here.
Thank
on
you.
Open mic. Tomorrow we've got people. Charlie Baker here.
Yes, we do.
Mic, do we not?
Excellent.
Okay, thank you very
good
much.
Good to see you, Reverend Rivers.
As always, you go to the Red Sox game?
In spirit.
You ever been opening day, Gene Rivers? Inside the stadium?
That's good. I was going to say yes, right? No.
You've
I've never been either.
That's three of us. Better luck next year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Take care, Jane.
Thank you very much, Gene Rivers. Coming up, we're looking at how running became a healthy addiction for a man who used to be addicted to drugs and alcohol. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
The graying of Cape Cod is an undeniable trend.
The old paradigm here was people went off to college and then they came back when they wanted to settle down. And what we're not getting is that boomerang effect of them coming back.
I'm reporter Sean Corcoran. We look at how higher education can play a role in training a workforce and retaining families on Cape Cod. Part two in our series tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition.
WGBH programs exist because of you and White Oak Cottages at Fox Hill Village in Westwood, providing assisted living care for those with Alzheimer's and dementia in a family home environment with 12 private bedrooms. WhiteOakCottages.com. And the Museum of Science, where science and technology come into focus. The Museum of Science is proud to sponsor a night of innovation and big ideas, Thursday nights from 9 to midnight on WGBH Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. You know, for more than a decade that Marjorie and I have known each other, we have been debating who ran the faster marathon years ago. I think the weight of evidence is clearly with me.
It's with me, actually.
But we will set aside our petty disagreements for one day at least to discuss a more serious side of marathoning a week before, actually, Boston's own. We'll do it with Caleb Daniloff. He's the author of Running Ransom Road, Confronting the Past One Marathon at a Time. Caleb, it's great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'll tell you, Caleb, I've known you for a while. I didn't know until reading this book that you were some kind of party animal. We're talking drinking, drugs, getting thrown out of school, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
And now you've written this book about running marathons. Are you running next week in Boston, by the way?
I'm not, unfortunately. I have run Boston, but...
You've run it several times.
I've run it once.
Oh, run it once. I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought you run it several times. But tell people, this is a fascinating book you've written about dealing with your addictions through running.
Right. So for running, for me, well, I guess I should back up a bit. For probably about 15 years, I had a pretty serious drinking problem and chronic drug use. And after I got sober, I found running, and I found running to be an incredibly therapeutic healing agent. And it allowed me to sort of confront the person I used to be and sort of get to know myself again and reach out to the people that I'd harmed. And I never sort of set out to be a marathoner. I'd always sort of run these backcountry roads in Vermont. And we moved down to Boston, and I sort of got sucked into the magnetic force field of the Hopkinton start line and decided to give it a go. And Boston was one of the places, sort of one of my sinning grounds.
You say sinning grounds?
Sinning
Is that the
grounds,
term
yeah.
you use? That's
yeah.
pretty good. Okay.
And so as I was training for Boston and running Boston, you know, a lot of sort of the old memories came back. And the experience of running Boston itself was very transformative. There were lots of people there who were sort of damaged in one way or another. So it was great to be among them.
What do you mean damaged in one way or another?
I'm sure there were other recovering addicts there, but I was running among the charity runners. So you would see, people wearing shirts with sort of the iron-on faces of deceased kids or someone or an uncle who had a liver problem and they were running for that charity. And so there were sort of these stories that were on their backs and fronts, and it was really sort of an emotional experience. And so from there, I just sort of thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to sort of run in my former sinning grounds, which would include New York and some places in Vermont and Moscow.
Virtually everywhere you'd been. Was in your sinning.
Right. Exactly.
We've been
exactly.
sinning for a long time. You have right. a lot of penance.
But by the way, you didn't
do.
Start marathoning to excise your demons. You had begun that. You'd begun to deal with your problems prior to becoming a marathoner,
That's
right?
correct. It just sort of evolved that way in
and
a
did
nice
you,
way.
You didn't say to yourself, I think marathoning is going to help get me even further down the line. It just happened.
No, it just happened, yeah.
And what was it about? What is it about marathoning that caused it to be so therapeutic for you?
I guess running itself, no matter how, whether you're out there for a half hour or for an hour, was very therapeutic. And, the idea of doing it, four or five times that amount, I sort of wondered, if I set that feeling against the backdrop of my past, what might come out of that? So it's a marathon is just sort of much more intense version of your regular run. But you're also in the community of other runners, and every runner really has a story. So it's that's the sort of the nice thing about a marathon is everyone comes together. It's such a solitary practice a lot of the times. So it's nice to sort of commune, with.
How many do you run a year now? Well, how often do you run?
I try and run one a year. The last one I did was Philadelphia in November, and I actually signed up for. The Pikes Peak Marathon, which is a kind of
temporary thing.
Yeah,
oh
I temporarily lost my mind last month and signed up. I'm still a little bit in denial. I almost don't like talking about it. But it's 13 miles up, 13 miles down, 14,000 foot elevation. So that's in August. So that's my next marathon.
So I read when you achieved sobriety, you were laying into the Ben and Jerry's and the
yes.
bacon pieces and stuff like that. So you started to gain weight.
Yes.
So how long were you sober before you began becoming a pretty intense runner?
I was probably sober a good 3 years.
Uh-huh.
I think the first year of sobriety was, was just nothing. I was finally able to quit smoking, as I wrote about. And, and when you quit drinking, there's this huge void that's left behind. And, and you fill it with bacon pizzas and I filled it with bacon pizzas and Ben and Jerry's and put on, like 30 pounds. I saw a photo of myself, the following year and was just absolutely disgusted. So it was really vanity that pushed me down the fitness track. And I started by, swinging a tennis racket and getting in the town pool and I really liked swimming, but I developed these ear infections So that didn't last all that long, and I sort of just found my way to a treadmill and slowly but surely sort of started up again.
What would have, I mean, I know this is all speculative, and, but let me ask it anyway. Caleb Daniloff, what if you hadn't discovered marathoning? I mean, you were down the road to sobriety, and you were obviously progressing, moving in a real healthy direction, but how far would you have gone, and how long would you have stayed sober and well had you not found this?
I don't know. It's a hard question to answer, and I guess I don't spend all that much time thinking about it, just because it's not a reality. People do ask, "What happens if you couldn't run again?"
That was my next question. Yeah. So, people includes me. What happens if you can't run again?
Well, there's other. I mean, I do believe in fitness. I mean, I do yoga as well, and I find there's and I know Marjorie, you do yoga.
Yes, hot yoga. We both do hot yoga.
Yeah, and there's a spiritual element there. And I think that element, you know, combined with fitness is very beneficial. But these days, it's like you can almost run in any condition. I mean, they're blind runners. You can run without legs and arms. I mean, there's practically no condition that you can't run in.
How do you run if you're blind? You have someone in front of you?
Yeah, you have a guide.
You have a guide.
You're sort of tethered. And, you know, I actually did a blindfold race once. And so
How far did you run as a blindfolded runner?
It was a 5K. It was for...
That's a long way. Was 3 miles or something?
Yeah, 3 miles. Yeah, it was around Boston College. You know, and I had my wife, actually, Chris, was my guide. You know, so we worked out some issues along the way. You know, she's pulling me into the trees.
There is that runner's high. I mean, Jim wasn't joking. He used to be a runner. I used to be a runner. There is that runner's high that you get when you get in that kind of machine mode where you're just sort of, it's all physical. And I think you get it from any kind of long distance sort of thing. I mean, your dad is a big rower.
Yep.
I mean, the long distance rowing, that's a huge thing. So don't you remember that runner's high, Jim?
Yeah, I don't remember. I've read about it. Speaking of your father, who obviously people know is a very famous journalist,
Nicholas Daniloff.
You tell a story about when you were not in good shape, about graduation day, where your father is to be. Tell what that day was like. Tell us about that day. He's smiling, by the way, which is, I think, a mark of recovery right here.
At the time.
I think he cried. Actually, I still feel a little bad about that. But it was my graduation day. I'd already been
from
Northfield Mount Hermon. It's a boarding school in Western Mass. And I basically had been getting in trouble since I stepped foot on campus. I was on disciplinary probation almost the entire time. I was suspended. It just was a very unsuccessful experience. And during this time, my dad was arrested. There was a lot of publicity around this. He was a Moscow correspondent.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the school felt they couldn't kick me out at that time because of all this publicity. So I got like 3 and 4 chances. And so the night before graduation, I just took off and went to a motel in Northampton with some friends and alumni. And it was just a party. And I, for some reason, didn't think they were going to do dorm checks because it was just seniors on campus. And they did. And I wasn't there. And they conducted this huge search. And, you know, everyone was very upset. And the keynote speaker for the graduation was my dad.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, they just figured they could not give me a fifth chance. You know, it was really a 3 strikes and you're out kind of place. And so basically they brought me to the infirmary and, you know, where you're sort of put on suicide watch. And so I sat in the infirmary, you know, listening to my dad. He went ahead and gave the speech anyway.
Did he know what was going on with you at this point?
Yeah, he knew what was going on.
Did he have any doubts as to whether or not he should go ahead with this thing?
I think he did, but I think he just, you know, he just stuck to the plan. You know, I think.
What did you feel like? I mean, what was that like that day?
I mean, I can't. I was a little upset, I guess. Part of me, you know, I was 18. Part of me probably relished the notoriety of it. You know, I mean, I didn't have great relations with my parents at that time, so it wasn't something that devastated me. It just sort of was par for the course. It was normal.
That's the voice, by the way, of Caleb Daniloff. He's written a book called Running Ransom Road, Confronting the Past One Marathon at a Time.
You know, you must have thought a lot about addictive personalities, non-addictive personalities. Why do you think, because you were pretty young when you were doing a lot of drugs and psychedelics and drinking and stuff, why do you think you became an alcoholic and a drug abuser?
I mean, I wish there was like one easy answer, and I used to wish that there was some narrative, some dramatic narrative that, you know, an abusive babysitter or, you know, something like that, that I could just point to and say, this is why I am the way I am.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it's as I've learned, it's really a constellation of factors. I mean, I think there was some genetic predisposition. We have some alcoholic relatives. I was a persistent bedwetter as a kid, you know, well into elementary school, and that really sort of filled me with shame and put me on the outside. I mean, I couldn't go to sleepovers. So there was sort of an alienation that had already set in and this sort of deep shame that I walked around with. Then we moved to the Soviet Union when I was 11. My dad took a job for U.S. News and World Report. And they put me in Soviet school, Soviet pioneer camp.
Oh, my God.
So eventually I sort of went native. And, you know, of course, then our time there ended with my dad's arrest. I came back to the States, and I didn't know what an American was or what it meant to be an American. I was just very, very confused.
Yeah.
And sort of already alienated, and, you know, I was very sort of obsessed with finding out about drugs because it was, you couldn't get them in Moscow.
Just vodka.
Just vodka, yeah. So I went full tilt boogie at boarding school looking for any drugs I could get my hands on, and so, I mean, I think it's just all these factors. I mean, I think a lot of it had to do with sort of alienation and insecurity and, you know, a lot of things that a lot of, you know, people deal with. Yeah.
Last question for me, Caleb. Do you I don't know if you're a preacher in this regard, but this worked for you.
Yeah.
When you deal with or talk to other people who have drug problems or alcohol problems, do you say, try this, it worked for me, this could have the same impact on you that it had for me, or no?
I mean, I might say that. I wouldn't say that this is – I wouldn't recommend it as the only thing. It's definitely a great tool, a sobriety tool. You know, I didn't do the AA route. I don't dismiss the AA route. I have no real problems with the AA route, and there's a lot of wisdom in those rooms. But I think running definitely can have a therapeutic and healing effect, and I think you really are able to sort of tunnel into – who you are and who you were, and really sort of get to know yourself again. And you know, it injects momentum back into your life and progress and forward motion. And
before you leave, if you can help us settle this argument, looking at me and Marjorie, as you see us sitting here right now, and you go in reverse roughly 30 years, who would you believe ran a faster marathon, Marjorie Egan or me? Be relatively honest. Go ahead.
I'm going to go with Marjorie.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Caleb Daniloff.
He is correct.
For being with us anyway.
Caleb Daniloff is a writer. His memoir, and it's really terrific, is Running Ransom Road, Confronting the Past, One Marathon at a Time. Caleb, thank you so much
Good
for
luck.
Coming
Thank
in.
You very much Thanks
for
so much.
Me. Thank you.
So if you did not sit through the 2-hour premiere of Mad Men's 6th season, find out what you'd missed or didn't miss. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
Americans have always been part of the rich story of food in New Orleans, but celebrity chef John Besh wondered why so few people of color led the city's top restaurants.
I think it has often been seen as just a dead-end job.
Now he's helping minority kitchen workers move up the ranks. He tells us how next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and New England Eye Center, affiliated with Tufts Medical Center, offering patients advanced treatments for all aspects of vision care in 7 convenient offices. Info at NEEC.com. That's NEEC.com. And Ring Central, now with voice conferencing for every employee and Salesforce.com integration. Ring Central is a proud sponsor of 89.7 WGBH and All Things Considered. More at RingCentral.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Even the music excites me. You know, when we originally scheduled this segment, I assume we'll be discussing how great the season 6 premiere was. But before we do, I'm hoping that Boston-based TV blogger and the man behind BoobTubeDude.com, Ryan McGree, can explain to us what actually happened in last night's two-hour episode of Mad Men. Ryan, it's great to see you.
We were confused, Ryan.
Well, if you think about Mad Men in the way that traditional television operates, and which is, you know, it's about a progression of a series of events, mm-hmm. Mad Men can be very perplexing. And as it's moved on, something that occurred to me last night, that the protagonist of this show, it's not Don, it's not Betty, it's not Pete, it's not Joan, it's mortality. Matt Weiner is really thinking about...
the creator, a writer, or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. He's thinking about... this is a show about death, the inevitability of death. And all of Roger's monologues last night to his therapist really highlighted, underlined, italicized all of those sort of things, the themes of this particular show. It's the approach to modernity. You know, one of the great things about the show is, oh, when it started, hey, here's a, it almost feels like an alien type of time. They look like us, they sound like us, but something is slightly off. The arc of the show is getting it closer to what we understand society to be. That evolution is fascinating, but also connects us ever more with these particular characters.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We have two questions for Ryan and two questions for you. Is one, if you saw the premiere last night, what'd you think? And did you know what to think after having watched the two-hour premiere? And secondly, where does Mad Men in general rank in the pantheon of great television shows? It is clearly great, even if I was confused last night. Now, you talk about mortality.
Yep.
Can we just play a little bit? Betty is out with the kids, with a kid and a kid's friend, and her mother-in-law, and they're driving home, and they're stopped by a cop. Here's a little piece of little piece of that from last night.
I came here because I'm looking for someone that I do want. I did not throw her away.
Yeah, you're a goodie, I can tell. Well, Miss Elizabeth Hofstadt Francis of Rye, New York, eyes blue.
It's a wrong bite. We'll get to the right bite in a second. Let's kill this one for a second. We'll get to that bite in a couple of seconds. Again, they're driving. Sitting to the right is the mother of her new husband, of Betty's new husband. And we're going to talk about how Betty got large.
Very large.
You're going to describe that to us in a minute. They're stopped by a cop. And again, listen to this. Listen to this.
You may not be aware, but this is Betty Francis. You may know her husband, my son, Henry Francis. He works in the mayor's office in Manhattan. I think all concerned will be very content if you issue a stern warning and let us be on our way.
Pauline. I'm trying to avoid taking you off the road with a shovel. She's driving like a maniac. Yell at her.
So that was the mother-in-law, and then that was the state trooper or whatever it was. So I see that scene, and I'm not exactly the deepest television watcher, Ryan, okay. But I will say I see that scene, and I say to myself, that means Betty's going to get in a horrible accident somewhere down the line, and we're supposed to then go back and say, aha, reckless driving 3 or 4 episodes ago. Just like when the show opens with Don and his new wife on a Hawaii vacation. They come back, they're meeting at the ad agency with the people who own the hotel, or at least the ad people for the hotel, and he proposes this ad thing called Hawaii, the jumping off point, and all the people in the room say it makes us think of suicide, and I go, oh my God, Don is going to try to kill himself in a future. All this foreboding is throughout the 2 hours,
Since the pilot aired, people have been trying to figure out who's in the opening credits. Mm-hmm. It looks like Don. Is it actually Don? Is it actually someone that's supposed to represent Don per se? In terms of, you know, you talk what you might call Chekhov's parking ticket, whatever, from Betsy last night. If you look back at the last show that Matt Weiner worked on before this, which was The Sopranos. The Sopranos really tried to use expectations against the viewers, where if you think something is going to happen, usually it's going to go actually completely the opposite sort of a way. The Sopranos had this way of building up this huge amount of tension and then deflating it before you got to what would normally be, say, the shootout in the case of The Sopranos. So these could all be sort of misdirects, but the idea that the aura, this specter of death, is hanging over everyone is totally prevalent and will be there until the show ends.
Our number is 877-301-8970. So this is the 6th season of Mad Men. And
yes,
for those few who haven't watched or at least haven't read about it, it's about a 1960s ad agency, mm-hmm, with Don Draper, the fabulous looking, I think brilliant actor, both dramatic and comedic actor, John Hamm, who is totally brilliant.
Yeah.
He's sort of the point person. Then there's Betty, his former beautiful wife, who has now gained like 40 pounds theoretically, even though you tell us it's all prosthetics.
And she's still in love with him.
The last season, she was barely in it because of a real life pregnancy,
mm-hmm,
which was then augmented on screen. And because of the jump between seasons, between 5 and 6 was rather short as far as Mad Men goes. 8 months, roughly, between the last and now. Realistically, given the sort of workout regimens at the time, the weight really wouldn't have been there. So it's not a case of just trying to make January Jones continually look bad on screen. There actually is a sort of realistic basis for that type of weight.
And what's the agenda there? For those who didn't watch early seasons, totally beautiful woman, totally beautiful wife of Don Draper. What's the point that they're trying to make?
Well, it's about the disconnect between, you know, the increasing distance between the central characters and the times that they are in. I was watching last night and Don walks into his creative suite. And that used to be him and Peggy Olson, and they ran the world. And now they're these, you know, shaggy hipsters that he can barely recognize. They might as well be aliens to him. If you want to extrapolate that for now, it's like me watching my 5-year-old nephew on his iPad.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, the distance is amazing. To them, it's perfectly normal. But that sort of disconnect and the idea that I've done everything right and yet I am not happy. Look at Betty a couple of years ago in the trip to Rome. I mean, she was a model. She's beautiful. She's luminous. This is only a couple of years later. And now she's, you know, in derelict New York with these kids who are like squatting in a house with no electricity, no power. She couldn't be more matronly.
Yeah.
It happens when you're not looking for it. And that's something that you can definitely relate to. It doesn't matter if you're actually in the 60s or now. That's what makes the show so powerful. You can extrapolate those types of things because the show isn't about plot. It's purely about character.
I want you to know, listening to you for 4 minutes, I now understand more about the show than I did from watching for 2 hours.
Death, James.
877-301-8970. If you want to give us a review of the first of the premiere of the sixth season, 2 hours last night, give us a buzz. And again, we're going to get back to the details of last night's show. You mentioned The Sopranos. I think it's the best dramatic series in the history of television.
Sure.
Where does Mad Men rank in the, as I said, the pantheon of great shows? It is a great show, even if I don't understand every single episode.
Sure. It's very difficult to say. There's going to be this season and there's going to be next season. And that's the plan right now. The winners and AMC have publicly said seven seasons and done. That's part of the sort of recent trend in the last decade or so about planning out your end games, especially in something like this. When you look back 20 years from now, this is one of the five or six best. It's one of the most important shows, without a doubt, even
Why?
Taking its quality. In terms of the way in which it made AMC a brand,
okay.
The way in which it took things that started with FX and The Shield about making basic cable the type of place for this type of entertainment, to have adult entertainment. The place, you know, if you look at the great television dramas of the last 10 years, it has really filled the niche that, say, smart adult low-budget films used to do.
What are the great shows of the last 10 years?
You could look at Breaking Bad.
Yep.
You could look at The Wire. You could look at The Shield. Alan Sepinwall, a colleague of mine, wrote a great book about sort of the revolution was televised and sort of saying this golden age of television started with Oz over on HBO, has trickled down somewhat into the basic cable, really hasn't gotten into the broadcast models. A lot of that has to do just with the sheer amount of episodes you have to produce. You're on ABC, NBC. Generally, you got to do 22. That's even changing right now. A show like Mad Men, 13 episodes, really solid. Now NBC is doing Hannibal. And they're not doing it because of any reason other than they're desperate enough to get that sort of quality on their own network.
You know, when you're every commercial break last night, and by the way, our number is 877-301-8970. We'll get to callers in just a couple of seconds. Every commercial break, they did those spots where something more. And they had shots of their best series, like, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 second things. Obviously, I assume trying to say we're even more than HBO. Is that not where they're going there?
HBO is the goal is the gold standard right now.
But having said that, I've never seen until last night a Mad Men when it was actually broadcast. I usually have seen it, and to watch a television show in 2013 and have to sit through commercials. When you're used to the HBO model or Netflix or iTunes is really disconcerting.
Especially,
it's really amazing,
especially because Mad Men is not written with act breakouts. Like, it's not
written. That's a very good point, yeah. If
every commercial break feels like something went wrong, essentially, and it can take you out of the story if you're not binge-watching on Netflix or if you're watching on your DVDs, it is a different experience. Weiner's not writing for that. It's a concession that he has to make because of the logistics of television, but he would prefer it if there were no breaks whatsoever.
Binge-watching is my favorite new expression, but I love it.
My number is 877-301-8970. What you think of Mad Men's, or what you thought of Mad Men's debut last night, how do you think it rates with the other great shows? You mentioned a lot of other shows, Breaking Bad, The Wire, The Shield. You didn't mention Jim's obsession there, Homeland.
Homeland's great.
Homeland's fantastic. That's a show that has, you know, it's really trying to bridge the gap between being the type of character piece that, say, Mad Men is, and being the thriller plot-driven thing that 24 was, and the creators of 24 have come over to Homeland here. They got very interested in the Carrie-Brody dynamic on that particular show. Where season three goes will really determine what Homeland is going to be overall. It has a chance, but also it's a very different type of show. Homeland may be the start of the next generation.
Why is that? I mean, television. By the way, you know, I just saw Zero Dark Thirty the other night. I promise we're going to get to the calls in a minute. I saw Zero Dark Thirty, and when I watched Jessica Chastain mm-hmm. as sort of a variation on Claire Danes' character in Homeland, Jessica Chastain can't hold a candle to Claire Danes. I mean, not even a candle.
And one of the things that makes Homeland so exciting and part of this new wave is that the golden age of television, Steppenwolf's book that I was talking about before, is largely defined by the male anti-hero. You know, it's the Tony Soprano in variations thereof. Now, with shows like Homeland, The Americans, you can look back at Damages with Glenn Close, women are getting to be just as flawed and varied as the men. That's very exciting and healthy for the genre overall.
Let's go to Tammy from Waltham. Thanks for calling, Tammy. Go ahead.
I wanted to talk a little bit about what I have seen as a recurring theme from virtually from day one, and that's been one of identity. It's mm-hmm. certainly obvious that it's a question with Don Draper, but it's recurring through so many characters, changing societal roles, changing sexual roles, whether it's female roles, but even how Pete is portrayed with his various issues, or Roger certainly looking at a transformation there. It's just been continuous all the way down to eventually, theoretically, we would see that in baby Kevin, in Joan's son, who will ostensibly be misled about who his father is.
That's a great point, Tammy, the identity thing. Thank you very much for that call. What do you think?
Well, I think it's absolutely right. And one thing you look at, especially as the years go on, is that you can see one person turning into the generation ahead. Roger's turning into Bert. Don's turning into Roger. Pete's turning into Don. I mean, there are the ways in which not only you are fulfilling identities, you're filling archetypes. You know, not only the ways in which you try to, you know, maneuver around these things and somehow you find yourself ending up exactly in the same spot that you are. But people are trying on, you know, not only as the caller pointed out, you know, Don Draper, that's not even his real name, as we all know. It's easy to forget sometimes.
Yeah.
But the lighter in last night's episode is a great sort of reminder of like that fiction, which we even as viewers just sort of assume and interiorate. It's right in front of us all the time. We're not looking at the thing we're looking at.
Let's just to describe the lighter. Let's at the beginning of the of last night's episode, Don and his wife, his second wife, are in Hawaii on vacation. After he and his wife have sex, I guess is what happened, mm-hmm. or we think they did.
You couldn't tell.
She falls asleep. He goes to the bar by himself, and this young guy, who's a private in the military, who's drunk, sits down next to him. Here's a little piece of that scene.
So how do you feel about giving away the bride?
You don't think your friend's going to make it?
Nah, he's my best man.
I'd love to help you out, but you don't even know me. I think you'd regret it later.
I believe in what goes around comes around. One day, I'm going to be a veteran in paradise. One day, I'll be the man who can't sleep and talks to strangers.
And but that private who's sitting there is getting married the next morning.
Yep.
He doesn't have anybody to be the giver away of the bride, so he asks Don to do it, and Don does it. And the next image you see is him standing on the beach when his wife gets up. This is Don's wife taking a picture of Don at 8 a.m. Doing the wedding. So the private is Don. Is that the – I mean, what's the
– It's somewhat of that, but also it's about the disconnect between what the private sees in Don mm-hmm. and who Don actually is. The shameful Don is something he never lets – the world see, but we understand that not only through the flashbacks, which were in the first couple episodes, but you know, right after his divorce, he was hiring women basically not only to have sex with him, but to beat him halfway through. This is a man who feels he deserves to be punished, and that's at the end of the episode. You know, what do you want for this new year? I want this to stop. He wants to somebody to save him from himself.
That's what he says. Isn't that what he says? Yep. What's the new – when he's in bed with the doctor's wife on New Year's
doctor's
Eve?
Wife, Linda Cardinal.
She says, what's your New Year's resolution? Yeah. What does he say?
He says, I want this to stop. I want to stop doing this. Something along the lines of that.
I think he's out the window at the end of the next season. That's what I think. Mary from Providence. Go ahead, Jim.
877-301-8970. My apologies, Marjorie.
Mary from Providence. What do you think, Mary?
I think Don's looking a little haggard. All the smoking and the booze and the sex and the pot. I think he's sort of losing his je ne sais quoi, that appeal that he had. He's looking a little haggard.
You know, Mary, I'm so glad you mentioned the smoking, because it's always unusual, since hardly anybody smokes anymore, to see all these people smoking on television and the movies. But he was like practically lighting one cigarette from the end of the next one. There was a desperation about his inhaling, didn't you think?
I thought the same thing. He really takes that smoke in. And he's looking haggard. I mean, he's not the same Dom that we all fell in love with at the beginning of the show.
Hey, Mary, come on. Who among us has not thrown up at a wake of the mother of a friend? Mary, that is a fine call. And for those who don't mention, Roger's mother, 90-some years old,
yeah.
Roughly, yeah.
Dies. And
didn't care.
Don comes by himself and proceeds to throw up, and then the whole wake starts falling apart.
That's interesting, too, because, you know, he says that he doesn't care, but
right.
Obviously he displaces that. And he actually, the thing that makes him cry is the death of the shoeshine guy in their office, who barely anyone actually paid attention for. And again, the displacement of that type of thing. Don can be very giving to this private who he's never met, because there's no stakes in here. He never will let that person down. He's going to let Betty down. He's going to let Megan down. He's going to let potentially his office down. And I think the haggardness relates to that. You can only run so fast, so far. And as Roger pointed out last night, you're running through a series of doors. You think there's a destination. There's really only one destination. It's 6 feet under.
What happens when a viewer is originally – I mean, when I was drawn to Mad Men in the early seasons, and now we're in season 6, and our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to weigh in either on last night's 6-season, 2-hour premiere, or the series in general, or where it stands amongst the great dramatic series on television. I was drawn, like most people, Don Draper was just like this magnet. Mm-hmm. Was it Mary who just called a minute ago? Talks about the deterioration of Don Draper, and there's no evidence to suggest from last night it's not going to continue. How does the viewer who's been tied to the series for more than half a decade, how do they relate to a series where their guy all of a sudden starts to come apart at the seams?
It's a very interesting question, and I think it gets to the part of how much darkness can you sustain.
That's what I'm
in
trying
your
to
television.
Ask. Yeah, really, that's exactly right.
And it's something I get with other shows as well. Like
Breaking Bad is a perfect example.
Really depressing.
Right, and you know, Breaking Bad, that last 8 episodes airing this summer, are not going to end well if the flash forward we saw at the beginning of this, mm-hmm. the first half of that season, is any indication. But also, it gets to an interesting part about the anti-hero and the way these shows make us identify with and eventually root for. Where a lot of times what that happens is that the people who stand in their way, often the wives, become the villains. Whereas if you actually saw this in real life, you know, someone like Betty Draper might be a hero. Walt's wife on Breaking Bad might be the hero. We root for these people even though they do these deplorable things, often because they are put into the default perspective of the protagonist. And we're trained that we're supposed to follow this person and root for this person to succeed. Maybe not.
You know, that's a great point about last night. I'm not sure I agree if you're saying that we were rooting for Betty, because she was pretty pathetic last night. I mean,
not now, but then.
When you have a series where you're rooting for nobody, I mean, when they're all so despicable in so many ways and all such poorly behaved human beings,
yep.
I mean, that where does that take you?
You got to find your own particular entry point. My particular entry point is Peggy Olson. In terms mm-hmm. of people whom I have a vested interest in their success and happiness, I'd probably put her up there. I'd put Leslie Knope on Parks and Recreation. I would put several people for whom the aspirational points, that arc, there's actually hope for Peggy. I'm not mm-hmm. sure there's hope for Pete. There's definitely not hope for Don. But I almost feel like a show like Mad Men, the jumping off would be too easy. I think that's letting that character off the hook. The idea that this person just keeps on living and stewing in their own regret
yeah.
and remorse is more punishment. And we can get to the end of Sopranos for exactly that type of reason. That feels like a different
segment.
Why,
it's funny you say that. We only have a minute left. I'm already worrying 2 years in advance about what the final episode of Mad Men is going to be in light of how we were left with the Sopranos. And by the way, I hated it when I first saw mm-hmm. it. I watched it again. I sort of liked
better
it.
And better.
And then by the third or fourth time I saw the finale, I loved it.
It could be anything, but because again, we're not about – it's not about plot. It's about character, about where we need to get resolution to these arcs in a way that we understand we've taken a journey with these people and have a sense of where they might go, but it's not closed off.
I only have 30 seconds left. Question, a variation on what I asked somebody
yes.
here the other day. Why is it we can't accept Tony Soprano, at least I can, any other role,
yeah.
and John Hamm does tons of things and he's great in all of them. Why is that?
It's a very good question. I think the titanicness and also the cultural impact of The Sopranos. Mad Men, really, as much as we talk about it, there are more words written about it than people that watch it. Sopranos was a cultural phenomenon. This is still a very powerful show. It will go down in history, but it's still in terms of overall entertainment, still a niche piece.
Thank goodness you watch. That's all I can say, Ryan.
John Hamm did a great job in doing Saturday Night Live as Scott Brown. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. He's a great comedian. He's a great actor.
It was fantastic. Great.
Hey, Ryan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank
What's the website one more time, please?
BoobTubeDude.com.
You are the BoobTubeDude.
That's me.
Not.com. Thank you so much, Ryan. Great to see you. Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you guys who joined us today. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us all the time on the web at WGBHnews.org/BPR. Follow us on Twitter at Boss, as in BOS Public Radio, and Facebook.com/BPR. Tomorrow in studio, 12 to 1, the governor of the Commonwealth. And that will come a day after the debate begins in the House of Representatives on his budget and the House's budget and some rejection from the governor. He'll be here to take our questions and yours from noon to 1. You can email him in advance also. I am Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan.
Thanks so much for being here. Happy opening day. Bye.